Hello, and welcome back to the Few and Far Between podcast, conversations on the cutting edge of clinical research. I'm your host, Chris O'Brien. Today, we are continuing our eye-opening conversation with Jamie Haywood, health sciences engineer and entrepreneur. In part one of this episode, we talked about the first steps in Jamie's journey in biotech and patient solutions. It's fascinating. If you haven't heard it, please give it a listen. In part two, we're going deeper into the story's details, from funding his recent ventures to his takeaways about efficacy in drug regulation and policy. At one point in the podcast, Jamie asks a question: should humans have the right to study themselves? This belief drives his philosophy in working towards a better pathway and a better life for everyone, regardless of wealth or status. So without delay, here's part two of our interview with Jamie Haywood. Let's jump in. So when you started the company, did you guys raise money early? And if so, what were those conversations like? Because I'm trying to put myself back into the headspace of, here's this crazy guy. He ran a nonprofit. It's pretty interesting, but it's a nonprofit. And now he's got a company and he's talking about capturing data and reducing your disease to, you know, a set of performance trackers and sharing those. And wait, what is this?
When we started, I'd had a collaborator that promised to fund the company. And so my brother and Jeff quit their jobs, moved back to Boston. We were working together. And unfortunately, this guy's board wouldn't let him do it. So it was conflicted. So our first funding fell through. And then Ben and Jeff kind of worked for almost a year building the site and the platform. And then I tried to raise money the whole year. And I got, as you said, these were sort of rejections like, oh, this is really neat. What a great idea. How the hell are you going to make money? This is really neat. What a great idea. How the hell are you going to make money? And I was starting to get a little hopeless. I'm having a similar experience now as I'm raising more money this time, but I had a similar experience now, which is like, I'm so stunned at how capital is. We'll come back to that actually, because I think capital, but the great story about funding it. So Marty Tenenbaum, who is an amazing individual, and he was did the first commercial transaction on the internet with a company called CommerceNet, and started a whole organization that was helping in ideas. And he has a company called Cancer Commons. And now he has trying to figure out how to do a little bit of patients like me work in cancer. He's really an amazing guy. So I'm sitting down with him at the Charles Hotel, which in Boston is like the VC center of the universe. Like you go to this place and there's Henrietta's table where every company in Boston was started 20 years ago, like at the table. So we're at the table with Marty for breakfast, and Ben and I are there, and I go through the whole pitch, and Marty says like, that's such a great idea. I really love it. It's like, he's like, how are you going to make money? And I finally just said, I have no idea. And he said, okay, I'll give you money.
Is that right?
Yeah.
The great unlock is candor.
I don't know. I've been so blessed. You have an idea about how the world can be better. Usually those ideas don't exist because the market is operating against them. Like there's economic drivers that prevent the idea from forming barriers. The greatest disruptions in the world, Google, Amazon, are the ones that overcame those humps, those barriers, particularly things like Google. And I think capital is just incapable of seeing simultaneously an innovation in a technology and an innovation in a market. They just don't, like traditional capital is like, it wants this one incremental step and show me how this one thing that we do will be better 20% and you can make money and I can prove it and your expressibles, and it's like, and I'm like, yeah, we could do that. We can follow those paths. But I actually think that the world is really ill-served by the optimization of that. The difference is there are really good people in the world that when you describe to them an idea about how you make the world better for people, they'll fund it. And some of those ideas have made more money than God. I just believe that you should tell people how you want the world to be better and why you're going to do it in a way that's fair. You got to work hard. You'll find the people that will want to make that happen. Humans don't exist to make money. Humans exist because we care about each other. And people forget that.
I love that. I did see something recently where someone said fundraising would be a lot easier if every venture firm had an honest description of their risk appetite and investment thesis, like what they actually want to do on the door. But sadly, that's not the case. So you're often going to be pitching to people who, you and I are both old enough to remember Internet 1.0, when there were really a lot of internet pet food companies. There were just
Pets.com
and three or four or five others, right? I mean, it was a crazy time. Lots of people felt like, yeah, it's reasonable for me to follow someone else into what is crazy idea. Nobody's going to yell at me too much because there's a whole bunch of other people doing it or something
that. I'm always amused by like people that made their capital by disrupting the system now following all the rules really amuse me. And then the other one is like, you go to your Pets.com one. It's like people that funded five companies that this purpose was to sell dollars for 90 cents.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Saying, oh, I don't want to build something disruptive or new. And I'm like, well, okay, how you doing selling dollars for 90 cents? Because like, to me, like you actually have to invent something that creates value for some new human being. And I, you know, we're so live, particularly in healthcare. I mean, I think we should talk for a minute about just how broken the healthcare market is, because I'm on the board of this organization called iCHOM, started by Michael Porter and a guy named Stefan Larsson. And it's trying to measure, you know, variable outcomes in the real world for healthcare. It's a beautiful organization. It develops standard sets. It works with the World Economic Forum, and unfortunately it's getting better traction in Europe than in the United States. But what's the point of all of that? Which is that the healthcare market, you know, drugs are so overvalued. There's no real comparison between new drugs and existing opportunities. So there's no head-to-head against comparability. There's no way to generate evidence without IP that is meaningful against the sort of current trial architecture. The regulatory framework supports that sort of monopolistic novel drug characterization. There's no data generation in the real world of competitive evidence against that, unlike every other industry. You know, I like to say, you know, Toyota knows more about the operational status of every water pump it made 5 years ago. It knows every single one of them, how well they operate, what broke, and then like, you know, how many they had to replace, why, what were the conditions of the car. It's all integrated multivariate data analysis. You know, Johnson & Johnson doesn't even know if the people that put hip replacements in last year are alive, let alone whether they're walking. It's crazy. The water pump costs $15 and the hip replacement is $2,500. Like, the system is insane.
Why is that true?
No, it's because information does two things in the practice. It creates liability and it breaks monopolies. And essentially the practice of medicine is monopolistic profit centers trying to hide their monopolies from insurance companies, other people. And then there's liability context in medicine for generating evidence. So you don't make any money generating evidence to do better, but you generate evidence by you screwed up. You're toast, right? So the whole system is really structured against validating or verifying it did the right thing for individuals, or to generate any value from it, or learn from it, or understood the real world multivariate components of it. And it's economically staying there. Like, it's the forces are getting stronger in the way the government is operating and the regulators are operating. So if we're going to disrupt that, I think we're going to have to do it outside the economics. The business plan of that patients like me with jujitsu, we had data that would help people, and we would sort of peel off someone else's economic channel in the drug companies. And that's how we made money. I mean, we did well, but we weren't generating direct, we weren't getting paid for making people better. And we knew we were making people better. You don't get paid for that. You just don't get paid for making people better. And information is the cheapest, best way to make people better. And until we pay for that, we're never going to generate information.
Do you think you're having more progress in Europe because there's more appetite for regulation and you have single payer systems, et cetera?
Yeah, I sort of have two kinds of healthcare systems in my experience. You know, bureaucracies, which in balance serve their own self-importance and their mission. Military is a bureaucracy, and actually it's very mission-oriented. So there are institutions that perform as bureaucracies, and police are bureaucracies. So they do a good job. Man, are they slow, and man, are they inefficient, and man, are they expensive. And so they go in the right direction, but they go in the right direction like lumbering, inefficient systems. And then we in the United States or other systems, we have these profit-driven systems that are just completely indifferent to whether they make anyone better. And they're just looking for margin to optimize. I mean, the healthcare system in the United States is, you know, units of profit searching for profit units, searching for people to operate on. I mean, it's just like, and so I think there are emerging self-pay systems that are better. And there are evidence models. Like, if you look at the transplant field where they have very good registries and you can really, like, you know, every organ that goes in human beings measured, every person's measured, every transplant center is measured on how well they do. You know, that's really good medicine, but it's driven by measurement. So it can be good, but it requires that. And so I think the disruption is going to come from the outside. I think it's going to be self-pay. And my work now a little bit, and I hate to say it, but it's like, I think we're at a point where with digital tools and digital biology and machine learning and thoughtful architecture, we can build a system that will be very expensive, but be so dramatically better that the wealthy will buy it because the healthcare system is no longer trustworthy. And I think that system can emerge. And then once that happens, you know, the same way, you know, cars emerged and then people started transitioning from horses to cars, we can bring it to everyone. But the current medical system, as far as I can tell, has no interest in actually doing better. other than making more money.
It's a wonderfully provocative statement. And I'm sure I would like to think some people listening are outraged by that and other people are nodding their heads, which is exactly what I'm looking for in this conversation. So the analogy where you think things can go, maybe it's more like Tesla, starting with this Roadster that was incredibly expensive and then eventually working their way down to the Model 3, which is, it's not a cheap car, but it's a reasonably priced car. Is that the right way to think about it?
I think we're getting there. So the gap I'm interested in now is there's sort of this, you know, 15 to 30 year journey between a new finding occurring and it being available sort of legally,
right,
and then being available to everyone. So if today I discovered, you know, some central new protein related to how to fix something, 15 years from now, there would be something that you could take to address that. And then 15 years from there, everyone would have access to it. So it's absurd, right? Like, you know, look at the display industry. Like, how long ago were we still in non-HD TVs and tubes? How many generations have we gone through since then? And now we're like 8K TVs with they're virtual reality environments, right? And they're getting better every year. That, like, if you just wait a year, your TV drops in price by half. It's just amazing, right? So imagine if medicine were like that. So to me, I'm looking at what's available right now. And if you look at what we can do with these really advanced research tools, which are still really stupidly expensive, but if you look at these incredibly advanced research tools in proteomics, metabolomics, lipidomics, you know, either using mass spec or reagent-based approaches or sequence-based approaches, they, for the first time, can characterize human biology and represent it. I liken it to the difference between, you know, looking through a photograph and you can take a straw and you can look at like 5 pixels, or I can take the whole damn picture. The difference is everything, right? And so to me, that exists and I've done work with it. I know it's real.
Jamie, do you think those expensive technologies, is this a Moore's Law play that sort of almost inevitably they will drop in price by somewhere between becoming a 10th or 100th of the cost today? Or do you think it's a lot more complicated than that?
There is a Moore's Law-like effect. It's not as fast. It's slower. The advantage in computing was that the pressure for cost at per unit computing was so great and the market opportunities were so great. The healthcare system's adoption inefficiency and regulatory barriers, and they're not really compatible with machine learning-based approaches. And so, unfortunately, the software, which would be like machine learning and comparisons that we would use for understanding human beings, is not compatible with the modern regulatory system. And so the pressure on the chips, as it were, the things that measure biology, is slower and not as much. And it's just not a very efficient clearing market right now, either for quality or quantity or volume. But it is getting cheaper. I mean, there's no question that 10 years from now, we could develop a $100 test that essentially measured and predicted all human disease if we chose to.
I love that you think that there's no question around that.
Scientifically, it's really straightforward. Whether the market will support that, allow that regulation, and how long it would take for that thing, if it existed, which would, you know, cost a lot to create, to come to the market. So that's the thing that we will spend $2 billion on the third attempt at a failed Alzheimer's drug without hesitation.
Yeah, right.
But no one will spend $100 million to determine if we can actually measure human health. It's just so insane. I don't even know how to think about it.
Put that way, it's hard to wrap your head around. A second ago, you said, I think, that machine learning approaches are not compatible with the regulatory environment. First of all, did I have that right? And is that because the algorithms are kind of black boxes and you can't? Why is that? Just ask.
I mean, the black box issue is part of it. For some reason, the way we've chosen to regulate claims do not allow you to build something that can learn. And so if I were to say, I believe this pattern of features that means this truth, that your smoking is likely to convert to lung cancer, or your obesity is likely to convert to diabetes, or your pre-diabetic, whatever it is, whatever the information is. The way I would do that is I'd demonstrate that in a trial, and then I'd have to validate that in a prospective trial. If I learned how to do it better in the second trial, I couldn't use that information to optimize the test. So you're sort of stuck on the knowledge off of your original undercapitalized study, 200, 300 people in some context, isolated. But when you bring it to the real world and you start to use it in millions of people, you don't get to learn in that environment and say, oh, I can make this better. You know, and I think that's the opposite of most functional markets. You find a defect, you fix it. And the cycles are 5-10 years, because these studies take years. And so to me, the claim that I would want to make on my business is, we're this accurate right now, and we're checking on most of our people whether our accuracy is continuing, and we promise to get more accurate. But we're going to change the technology we use and the algorithms we use, and that would make something that actually worked. Imagine Apple having to go through a 4-year cycle to publish new software every time they push it to your iPhone.
So obviously that's I think, both true for how healthcare works, and it's incredibly slow. It's incredible negative effect on the pace of innovation. How do you do that? How do you make it faster without taking undue risk on human life? And let's come back to that idea. You know, it's a little bit related to what we talked about Facebook and other technology companies. I know I've seen some very successful technology entrepreneurs come into healthcare, and they look, you know, they look like they got hit in the head with the 2x4 after a while, because the pace and the complexity are different maybe from what they're used to in other technology fields. So how do you do that? How do you speed things up?
Let's break it into two components. So one's a philosophical component, which is like, what should we regulate, right? I think that there is a very important need to regulate the safety of compounds that are ingested or used to modify human health. And I think we under-regulate supplements and food dramatically, and I think we probably over-regulate drugs slightly. And what I mean by safety is, you know, at a range of doses and frequencies of use, what are the negative consequences of using a compound in a human being? I do not believe that we should be regulating efficacy in the way that we do, because I think it doesn't produce particularly useful information about how to use these compounds in the real world. And I think it also slows a better matching of the compound against tasks, like how they're used in the real world, which would be better in a more diverse and open process. And third, it falsely creates this economic model where if you get approved, you get infinite amounts of money as opposed to the actual value of your product, like, you know, vis-a-vis this new Alzheimer's drug from Biogen, which I don't know why our society has to spend $20 billion a year on something that the evidence is overwhelming doesn't do anything, right? So those three problems are efficacy regulation. So that's a philosophical component. And I think I'm not sure we should be regulating information at all. I mean, to me, the diagnostics are, there's sort of a more of an FTC kind of regulatory thing. Are you doing what you say? I mean, full stop. Like, I mean, I think the idea that you prove something to someone ahead of time is just dumb. Like, the company should make claims and be able to be enforced for their failure to make claims through a different kind of regulatory framework.
Pause for a second on the philosophical piece, just to make sure I've got where your head is. So you're saying, I think, regulate safety, period. That's important. Make sure that we know that what people at dosage levels, that we know that if you take this drug in this way, we understand the side effects, if there are any, where those are documented and all this stuff, but don't regulate efficacy. Would you say at all, or would you say enforce, as you said, FTC style, enforce false claims made by drug producers, but allow doctors and people to utilize these medicines?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think what I would do then is I would impose a learning framework on new compounds, which made them responsible for for negative consequences economically, and force them to learn and validate positive consequences. So I think you could, we have drugs we spend $100,000 a year on cancer for, hundreds of thousand dollars a year, and in for rheumatology, $50,000, $25,000 drugs. 30% of the drug budgets is marketing. We could just put that into evidence generation on those drugs, instead. And I think we could fund an evidence generation system in care delivery, which is what I think we need. Transition take a while, but that's exactly right. Yes.
Jamie, somewhere there are a group of marketers planning to attack you, to destroy you as soon as possible. Those are big budgets that they're trying to...
But the whole point of marketing is to find the right person for your product. I'd rather that was driven by biology than, you know, how good the lunch was or charming the salesperson was. Like, that'd be a better variable. Like, you know, yes, I'm sorry.
I knocked you off track, or I think it was a good track to double.
But I have a different strategy.
Yes.
And my plan is different. So in my belief in my new enterprise, and this is philosophical, which is humans have the right to study themselves. And so we're going to do a research study, and we're going to enroll people with consent that are going to use experimental tools to understand their own biology and physiology in the context of their desire for a better life, healthcare system, whatever. And these people will consent to understand that we don't know how well these tools work, and we don't know how accurate this information is, and we're going to do this as a learning process. And we will track whether or not people that are using emerging information have better or worse outcomes. And so we're going to look at the risk reward of using direct information in our study. I'd like to see in the United States of America, where you have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that an ethics committee decides that human beings are not allowed to study themselves for the purpose of life or happiness.
It's the trifecta. It's all three, right?
It's all three. Yeah. We live in a country where you can life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Unless you're trying to pursue happiness or life, life, in which case you have to go through a government-sanctioned monopoly run by guilds that are unaligned with your interest and can charge you monopoly pricing, you know. But to me, now what you have to do then is you have to choose people carefully, because I do think that it has to be true consented choice. Like, so people that want clear answers, people that want certain, people that want the paternalism of someone to say, I know this or I know that, they don't belong. But I believe that there are in the world people that can and would consent to learning about themselves and building that new future. And I think that's exactly, I liken it to the emergence of, you know, 1982 and the personal computer, the 1980s and personal computer. Like before 1980, if you wanted to write a computer program, you went to MIT. You said, oh, I need a computer programmer. You went to IBM, three or four big businesses, just like today, right? Like, you know, but after 1980, you know, I remember, you know, with Ken Olson say, I think there's maybe like 2-3 people in the country need a computer, right?
Yes. Yeah.
You know, you look at that after that.
For those who don't know, right, at this point, the CEO of Digital, the big microcomputer company, the biggest maybe at the time, or one of the biggest
at the time.
Sorry, continue.
No. So then it got in the hands of people, and it turned out that people wanted to have information tools to learn how to make their lives better. And we use it to make their lives better. So I don't know why. I think we're at that moment in biology. I think the engineering is there. The comparability is there. There's work to do, standards to create, and things like that. But I think that we're at the moment where, you know, I call it individual biology or individual digital biology. But like we are at the moment where it is possible to study oneself against the corpus of the world's knowledge and do something actionable and effective. And so I'm building tools, the operating system, to do that.
So this is Alden Scientific, yes?
Yeah, yeah.
So tell us about the creation of this company. When did you start it? And I think you just outlined the thesis a little bit, but maybe say a couple more words about that.
So the company's not quite a year old, and it was started by myself and Jeff Cole, who was my partner, Patients Like Me, and worked with me at ALS Therapy Development Institute, did the work on the mouse replication studies. He and I have been partners since MIT, where this is our fourth time we've worked together. You know, we really sat down and said, what do we want to do with our life? You know, what's the thing we want to do? I've got a couple of drug companies I've worked on that are, you know, that are successful. And I drugs are cool, but I think they're kind of boring to make. And I said, well, what I want to...
Bite your tongue. I've got a contractual obligation to make that statement. Okay, continue.
Okay. But your job is to make them more boring. You got to make it efficient, right? Like, I have to disclose, by the way, my biotech company, AOBiome, hired you guys to do it. And you did an amazing job and you made it really boring. Like, we didn't have to do anything. Like, we wanted you to run this study. You did this amazing study. You gave us all the data back. We just handed it to the bankers. Like, we didn't have to do any work. You made it boring. So I don't believe it.
I'll certainly happily take that one. Okay. Sorry. Keep going.
And you were excellent, by the way, which is why we're having this conversation. But, and the drug work too, which is even better. Actually, can we touch on that as well? Because you told me that great story about culture, that your team was so excited about our drug that they stayed up for 3 nights straight to give us the results. I mean, that was so magnificent. And I was so excited to get them. But anyway, the company's called AOBiome. It's a bacteria therapeutic for dermatology. It's awesome. We'll stop the commercial, but it's what everyone wants. But going to not being boring, look, I'm 55 years old. I've noticed over the last 5 years, freaking reading glasses and, you know, and
I hear hairline
and like, and, you know, and I hurt myself and my muscles take a little longer to recover. And, you know, and I'm still pretty fit, but like I have to work out more to be fit. I'm getting pissed off about this, you know, and there's all these amazing technologies coming down the pipeline in longevity, like things that modify senescent cells and modify mitology and just like, and just there's so much that's coming. And I love life. I love learning. I love learning about the human condition. I love people. I love the generosity of the human spirit and what we can create together in art. And I want to have fun. I want to understand how this works so that I can align my heart and my brain and my dreams with my body and come them back to that great alignment. And I want to be 40 again and joyful and vibrant. And not because I want to live forever, but I just want to be vibrant. What I know is this thing is programmed to die. And there's a great paper that came out a couple of weeks ago that all mammals have the same death program and we're all going through it. But we know that we can change that program. We know that genetics can move it 25% pretty feasibly in a human being. And I have an APOE4 gene, which makes my risk of Alzheimer's a little higher. And, you know, and COVID is now linked to brain inflammation and Alzheimer's. And I had COVID. I want these things corrected. I like the way I think. I like the way I breathe. I like the way I am. It's not going to be done with traditional drug discovery. We're not going to find a drug that treats aging. There's not going to be any magic pills. There's not like, it's not like we're going to find a Gleevec or a triple cocktail and aging is going to go away. This is central to the programming of human life itself. It's central to the programming of biologic life itself. So we need subtlety. We need to understand the whole thing. So Alden Scientific is designed to use every measurable tool in the world to evaluate an individual against the context of all known science mathematically. So we're downloading all the data on drugs and cells and animal models and genes and all this stuff, and then all the human data about RNA and proteomics. And we're running our own study, as I told you about, where you can enroll. And we're going to measure everything that can be measured in me, which is, you know, proteomics, metabolomics, lipidomics, whole methylation sequencing, whole genome sequencing, RNA, antibody profiles, non-human DNA, all these things. There's commercial companies that do most of the stuff, and you can work with them all. Very expensive, thousands and thousands of dollars, $5,000-$6,000 a blood sample. But man, for the first time, we have a digital photograph of the biology of you, GPS, the location where you are. And then we can map that to where you are against every other human being we have directly measured. And then we can infer the map every human being that's ever measured in any other study. And so rather than doing science, say I'm studying ALS or I'm studying depression or I'm studying this, and we build these averages and groups, whatever it is, Chris, I can take you and I can build the whole world of science around you. I can level all the data around you and look at all the connections to the data, and you can build an individual model of you. And instead of saying, hey, I've got this drug, I'm going to go look for people to take it, you can say, Chris, what's my RFP? Molecular RFP to make me the way I want to be.
Molecular RFP, my God, I love it.
And then it'll come back and, you know, a little bit of change in diet or supplements or some drugs. And then all these existing drugs that we never understand or use or compare, they can be evaluated and measured against the new ones. So the drug companies finally be able to do something better. Don't give me another similar thing that you patent and market with a bunch of cheerleaders and, you know, quarterbacks and say, oh, you know, look at this. I got to the market. I've got a better version of this. No, beat the things we have. Earn your damn money. Go earn your money. Be better.
So, okay, someone listening to this who is saying amen, how does this person get involved? Where are you in this project?
All right, so where am I in this project? So I have a bunch of really good friends that have given me money to build this together. And largely, you know, we're funding it with a safe note right now. We're in the middle of raising money. We're looking for, we have some great investors that are involved. We're trying to find the way to really build this out. But how do you get involved? We're so stealth right now. I think we just have a sign up on the website that you can put it. It doesn't even say what we do, but we're early. It's very expensive what we're doing, like hundreds of thousands of dollars a person. If people are interested in either that are doing disease research and they want to fund us, that's one of our customers. We're working with a group now at MIT that's doing chronic Lyme. If you're interested in personal individual biology and you want to do this at a depth, if you want to pull 15 years of the future forward into yourself, recognizing we're going to make a lot of mistakes and we're going to learn together, we're happy to talk about it. And I'm looking for, frankly, capitalists that are not interested in a spreadsheet about how I changed this diagnostic FDA process or when an insurance company is going to buy it, but realize that if you can actually tell people how to live a better life, the market will probably form around you.
I like this. I like that thesis. It seems like a strong place to be standing for that part of the conversation. Okay. You talked a few minutes ago about self-pay versions of healthcare that you're starting to see emerge. Are there specific examples of that that you point to that you think are clever or seem like they're getting traction? I don't think many people listening would say, yeah, things work great. The system is perfect. There's a consensus view that it's broken. Problem is people don't know what to do about it, I think.
There's a lot of layers to your question. I mean, I'm a member of One Medical, which Amazon just bought. I literally, just for the customer service, I mean, it's just, they answer the phone. Literally, you pay someone $200 a year to answer the phone. It's a great deal because they never answer the phone at Beth Israel. But that's one side of it. I think there's a very large growth in the very high net worth concierge practice. You know, the practices are more than $10,000, $20,000, $50,000, $100,000 a year. And I think what people are paying for is they've recognized the health system's untrustable. And they're paying for someone to put the management time in to helping them figure out who they should trust. And it's not that they're not great people in the health system. I mean, the people in it are amazing, but the institutions are not. And so it's a little bit like people that are, you pay an architect to build a home you want, you're paying your concierge to build the life you want. That's growing. And I think that there are other evidence. So when you look at whole genome sequencing first came out for cancer, you know, a lot of people were self-paying for that before there was any reimbursement, and that drove the market. And so I think there are areas where, you know, diagnostics that worked did drive the market a little bit. And so that's another example of that. And then, you know, psychiatry, most good psychiatrists, a lot of this stuff's all gone, you know, self-pay. So I think a lot of markets that deliver value in that context are. I think the problem is that the costs are really in the hospitals. And once you go into the hospital system, it's very hard to get out of that. And so no one's figured out how to manage that. I think at the very high end, preventing the hospital from doing harmful things is healthy, but it's hard to stop them from taking money and spending it badly. I don't know how that's going to work. And I don't know if I see a model yet. I do know, I mean, like I'm a business you're a business, we both buy healthcare, right? It's this massive line item for us, right? It's a massive line item for you. Do you feel you get a dollar's value for it? I mean, like, you're paying to essentially not apologize for delivering parabolic. Like, if someone came to me and said, I've got a better plan, you know, and I don't know where that's going to come from or how it's going to come from, we would both buy it in a second, right?
For sure. Yeah.
I mean, so I don't know where that's going to come from. I don't know how you control the imbalance in the system. I do know, I think with what we're doing, there might be a new system, which is, you know, we have sick care, right? That's what we buy. We buy insurance for sick care. I could imagine a healthcare plan where we paid to keep our employees healthy and built that. That I could see.
Yeah. I think there'd be a huge appetite for that today. You know, we have seen declining lifespans in America now several years in a row. As I said, I don't think anyone would argue it's working great. And everyone who runs up against the insurance industry and for family members or themselves, no one's happy with that. Someone out there, please come up with an alternative, I guess. Jamie, if you think about, I'm going to sort of go to in a completely different direction now. If you're talking to a young person who's coming out of school, coming out of college, let's say, and that person is interested in just leading a meaningful professional life of some kind, I'm sure you get asked this question. Like, what advice do you give people? You've had a weird and exciting and interesting career so far. You've bounced around, you've switched industries early in your career. You've started a bunch of things. You've had an enormous impact. So what do you say to someone who says, what should I do?
I remember when I left, I was at the Neuroscience Institute when Stephen got sick. And when I left to start ALS-TDI, it was terrifying. You know, I'd been a successful entrepreneur, a successful engineer. I'd saved up some money. You know, I'd already owned a house. Like, I'd become successful. And then, you know, the definition successful is the way, you know, you were expected to be successful at 30 years old. When I left without a job and without an organization, and I wrote this business plan in the middle of Oklahoma in a truck as my wife drove, I thought I'd left into the abyss, that all of the anchors that held me in the world were gone. And I was so scared. I was terrified. You know, I think it is a neat thing to recognize that the roads that we drive on, that the walls are porous, that you can walk across country. And I think it is neat to know that you don't have to follow the path. And in fact, I remember my wife at the time was got her PhD at Penn in French literature, and she was trying to become a professor. And she was so scared that if she didn't get the first round and the first jobs, that she would never get a chance to be a professor. And I said, well, who are the professors at the universities you like? And she told the names. Like, well, how did they get there? And only about a third of them had gone through the traditional path.
Really?
And you know, and I remember once I was talking to a guy that was asking me, he wanted to get into business development. He was a scientist. And he said, I want to go study, you know, how patents work, and I'm going to go study contracting and things like that. And I was like, okay, well, those are decent ideas. Who's in charge of business development? And I said, oh, he's this guy, doesn't even have a PhD. He had this company and they sold it. And now he's in. And I said, well, maybe you should go open a donut shop. Right. You know, so I think we believe what people tell us you should do. And I think we should be very careful of the word should. I think use your eyes, observe, trust your own instincts. The roads are there because that's where people walked in the path, but the world changes around them and there are new paths and you can see them. And then the other thing I would say is the more you can get free of obligations so that you can take less, so that you can do what you want, the better your life will be. And trust yourself, by the way. It's terrifying. It's tons of work. I will say, you know, people that, you know, look at what I've done or other entrepreneurs and say, oh, I want to be like that. It's a pretty terrifying, miserable, difficult existence to rip something into reality. You know, if you've ever seen a birth, it's a pretty traumatic event. And different is hard. It's very rewarding, but different is hard.
Mostly when people talk to entrepreneurs, they're talking to successful entrepreneurs about their successes. And it's a little bit of, gee, how did you get to be so handsome and all this stuff? Will you spend a minute on the part where there's blood and everything else all over the place? Will you tell us a story about the struggle? I think it's weirdly comforting for folks to hear examples of stuff like that.
So first off, every single enterprise I've ever involved in has had, you know, times of just this summer at Alden was sort of a little bit one of those. These times where it's just like, because you make promises to people about what you will do, and you make promises to people that work with you about what you're going to do, and you have to connect those and manage those. And your job is to make it as honest and truthful to everyone as possible. And it's a really lonely job to be a CEO. And there are times when things are just not the way you want them to be. And I tend to think of that as like, you know, there's always a chapter in the book when the hero has their darkest hour. Like, you have to go.
Yes, yes.
You have to write that chapter, but it's not fun to write that chapter. Boy, is it really not fun to write that chapter?
That's how I'm going to start telling myself that. Like, oh, we're in chapter six, man. This is the dark one.
I can't wait to write chapter 10. But like right now, it's just like, you know, so that's the chapter. And then that's part of it. But also I lost patients like me. What happened was we merged our company with a company called iCarbonX, which was founded by Jun Wang, BGI. And he and I, it was just like twins. I love, he was a human being as a scientist. We were so excited about building this global digital health enterprise. And we bought two other companies and merged them. And it was just, I ran R&D and I just was joyous at what we were doing. And we built an early version of what Alden is doing in a different format, but that's why I know Alden will work. And then we got cross sides with this US-China trade war, and CFIUS, which is the Committee on Foreign Investment in the US, just disavowed the investment and forced the divestment of the company. And anyway, we lost everything. Well, I lost everything. June still has the enterprise in China. You know, and all the US investors that spent all that time building patients like me and these other companies, it was just devastating. And I, as an entrepreneur, I was like, you know, I follow all the laws, I do everything right, you know, and we were the first biotech sort of damaged by this law in the United States. It's now being applied pretty broadly. And for people that don't know, I mean, there is an economic war going on with China that was sort of undeclared. Now it's more declared, but I don't know if it's good for the world or not. And I certainly want to be supportive of America and democracy. And I've worked for the CDC. I love my country, but it did not treat my enterprise well. And 15 years of my work went away. And it's like losing a child. You know, you spend 60 hours a week for 15 years building something you love, and then people met up with people you love. It's very hard to lose that. The positive of that is the humility comes from it, which is, and I think there's more luck in what transitions across the threshold. There are more asteroids that hit things than people understand rather than mistakes. I didn't make any mistakes. You know, I did it right, but I got hit by an asteroid, right? And, you know, and I'm obviously still very successful and I have enough to not worry about life, but like, I like myself better for having not had a golden path. I like how I think, how I relate to people.
Oh my God, that's a great comment. Say why. Say a little bit more about that.
Because it reminded me of what life is like for most people. There's a lot more loss, complexity, and stress, and things that make life challenging. And just to come back and experience with empathy, and not in the same way, but like, you just get disconnected if the world is too gold. And I struggle with that. A lot of the sort of hyper wealthy friends, I have a lot of them. Like, you know, you can just miss the world. And there's a lot of really interesting, amazing people in the world that don't fit the mold of everything being just right. Someone else said that the other day. I forget. It was one of the pop stars that said, like, how do you remain interesting? I said, well, make sure a number of your friends are not the ones that you should be friends with.
Uh-huh. I like that. I think one way to think about the human project is that we're all in the process of trying to become more empathetic. You know, no 2-year-old is empathetic. A 2-year-old are all, you know, would be sociopaths. And fortunately, they're not actually able to hurt you when you have a 2-year-old, but there certainly are times where they would like to.
Oh yeah.
Right. If you see the human experience as this journey, hopefully towards empathy, then I think you're right that hard things and sad things increase our capacity to empathize. Probably
they do. Humanity is so beautiful. Like, our capacity for invention and creation and art and compassion is just, it's just so beautiful. And I think the fun thing about going between the lines, stepping out of the world of economics that says you do things this way and, you know, here are the monopolies and here's what you do. Like, it's fun to help people. It's fun to make their lives better and to have them thank you for it, you know, and good businesses should do that. That's what really being an entrepreneur is.
Jamie Haywood, I think we're going to call it there. I don't think I think of a better line to end on than that one. Thank you so much for this conversation. I learned a lot. I want to do another one because there's a bunch of stuff that in my list that we didn't even get to, but this was really fantastic. So thanks, Jamie.
Thank you so much, Chris. And I look forward to taking our drug through approval with you.
Here, 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 here.
Let's, here.
Let's go.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the latest episode of Few and Far Between. If you enjoyed this podcast or have suggestions for future episodes, please get in touch with us. You can email us at fewandfarbetween@biorossi.com or contact us on our website at biorossi.com.